look at life on Earth, it's quite diverse. But behind closed doors, biologists will admit to one another that as diverse as life is on Earth, it all shares common DNA. Everything. Mm. Mm-hmm. So take bananas, for example. Humans and bananas share 25% identical genes.
Right.
Humans and bananas. If aliens come from another planet,
yeah,
if they have DNA, they're going to have no DNA in common with us at all.
Right.
And if they don't have DNA, in either case, you'd expect them to look at least as different from us as we and bananas look from each other.
Right.
And so many renderings of aliens by people's imaginations over the last century do not capture this.
That is the great Neil deGrasse Tyson, my good friend, brilliant astrophysicist. And we're going to do an episode here. We're talking about alien life, if it exists, and all the things that surround that question. It's based on his book, Take Me to Your Leader. Really cool conversation. Before we get to that, a couple of things. Touring, September 26th, one show at the Tin Pan in Richmond, Virginia. Really cool venue, doing stand-up there. October 22nd, 23rd at the House of Comedy, stand-up in Minneapolis, Minnesota. November 7th, my Broadway show, Permission to Speak, at the Guard Theater in New London, Connecticut. Beautiful old theater. November 13th and 14th, stand-up at the Ram's Head stand-up venue in Annapolis, Maryland. Sold-out shows there, so coming back. Hope you guys can come out and support me. Go to paulmercurio.com, my website for tickets. You know, if you want to help a guy out, you know, late show's over, out of work, I'm living in my car. But, you know, if you want to help a guy out. Real quick, before we get to the Neil Tyson conversation, one of the things we talk about is what would aliens make of the world that we live in right now? And I think the biggest question that they would have, and we would have no answers, and they'd come up with no answers, is what is this thing called professional pillow fighting? There is literally a thing called professional pillow fighting where adult men in a ring with a referee have pillows and they fight like 11-year-olds in their bedroom. You do with this what you will. There's a lot to unpack. Are they using a goose down pillows? Is it polyfiber filled? Are they? Do you have to use a certain grade of Egyptian cotton pillowcase? Are you allowed a timeout to run the mom if you got hit in the face and it hurt too much? Does somebody have a timeout in the corner if they get too aggressive? A lot of questions to unpack. So, but enjoy Neil Tyson and this conversation. It's really fun. Interesting. He's funny. As you know, I guest co-host Star Talk with him as well. And just always a great time together. So enjoy the conversation. Hope to see you on the road on tour.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the show. Very special guest this week, my dear friend. Pretty smart guy. Astrophysicist, director of the Hayden Planetarium, best-selling author, and host of Star Talk, which I'm always honored to guest co-host sometimes. And my pal, Neil deGrasse Tyson. Hey, buddy.
Thanks for having me back on.
Absolutely, yeah. Man.
Just my second or third incarnation.
I think this is your third, and you start to get some kind of a stipend. Third. Yeah, you get
a bag of bagels
and some cream cheese. How we doing, man? You good?
Good, good. The universe is good. And When the universe is good, I'm good. It's Earth that's messed up. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah, we're the problem. We're gonna talk about your book.
You the problem.
You are the problem. Together, you and I are really the problem. We're gonna talk about your book today. Take Me to Your Leader.
Well, thank you for that. This is so important.
Yeah, it's so great. And I wanna sort of start off it seems to be what your goal is, which is to, I think this is a quote of yours, which is to anchor everyone's enthusiasm and conversations about intelligent life into real science. So
kind of intelligent life in the universe, right?
Yeah. Give us your perspective on that and like sort of what the motivation for the book was and why you went at it from this direction.
So the title, Take Me to Your Leader, of course, is the classic first line we might expect an alien to hand us upon landing. This presumes that they can speak and that they know English, of course.
Why wouldn't they? We're so important.
English, right? Not like Sudanese or Swahili.
French, anything. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So, and so my thinking, well, just let me back up just briefly.
Yeah.
Ever since I was a kid, I wanted to be abducted by aliens. And I haven't been to, I don't lead with that desire, but it's been there because I was an amateur astronomer as a kid from age 11. And I'd be out there with my telescope and the, you know, either on the roof of my building or in someone's backyard. And I only ever had these feelings when I was alone. If there were other people, I'd be showing them Saturn and I'd be like being, you know, educator Neil, but alone, me and the telescope and the universe, with the telescope as a conduit to the cosmos, I would just look up waiting for that beam of light to come take me. And it's not because I wanted to leave Earth, you know, I love me some Earth, but there was the immensity of the universe. I just wanted to find out how other people, other entities, engage it. And so it's my curiosity transcending Earth, I think.
So you basically defy all the rules as a kid, like don't get into strangers' cars. Like, so the spaceship show, the alien doesn't, the door's open. They don't even have to have candy. You're just going right in.
Yeah. My parents never said, don't go in an alien spaceship, but just a stranger's car.
Right? Oh my God. So, but you know, just to divert from the different ones, I can attest to your just passion. I worked at the Late Show with Stephen Colbert, which is the 53rd and Broadway. And I'm talking to some people on the corner outside and you happen to walk down the street, give me a big hug. And within 30 seconds, you're giving these people a tutorial about the sunset and the sun and whatever. And they were like, oh my God, I can't believe Neil's talking to us. And then an hour later, they're like, oh my God, I can't believe Neil's still talking to us. I gotta go. We're trying to get to a Broadway play. No, you this passion that you have is just...
I forgot we did bump into each other. It was right outside the theater.
You really did make their day. But so you had this passion as a kid. And you just had this sort of, you have this endless curiosity, as we all know.
My curiosity as adult, curiosity as an adult is no different from the curiosity expressed in children. Mm-hmm. I just never grew out of it. I think that's what it is. So adults see me as a weirdly curious adult. But if you saw kids do that, so they're just being a kid. Yeah. So I think of scientists as kids who grew up physically, but not sort of mentally. They want to turn over every rock, look behind every tree. Well, what's that? Let's plug this into the wall.
Wait, I'm not supposed to put this fork in these holes? Hang on.
Not all experiments are in the interest of your longevity. So curiosity does have its limits.
Exactly. Maybe getting on a strange spaceship without telling your parents, but that's okay.
However, I mean, so look at the origin of curiosity, or rather the origin of curiosity tamped down. So we're in the Serengeti in the brush and the grass rustles, right? Mm. And I wonder if that's a lion. Let me go check.
And then the rest of the planet goes, that's a lion. Let's get out of here. Yeah. Everybody's going this way. You're going that way.
You get summarily removed from the gene pool. So complete unbridled curiosity has its limits. That's all I'm saying.
But there's like three things that came out to me in reading the book that you want to accomplish. Put science back into the alien conversation.
Yes. Thanks. That's the number one thing, because everybody's just floating away, believing anything they hear. And it is possible to anchor this conversation.
Yes. And expand our imagination about extraterrestrial life and use. This is really, really fascinating. We did this third one is use aliens as a mirror for humanity, which is really a great perspective.
No. Just to be precise, use human inventions of aliens as a mirror back to society. You know, how many, you can count on one hand, how many alien movies where the aliens are just friendly and they just, you know, want a belly rub.
Right.
You know?
Right. And they conveniently have a head and eyes and sort of arms, but they're not, they're different, but not too, it's, yeah, it drives me crazy. Well, you right, say, right.
But a trope, an alien trope is that they come and they want to slaughter us. Right. And the first one out of the box on that was H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds. All right. There was no negotiating with them. These were Martians that came to just kill us.
Right.
And there was a, can we talk about, no. And this just repeated.
We have an appointment. We've got to kill you and get on to the next planet. Well, you say, you talk about in the book, like, and we've talked about this just off air. It's like the bigger problem is not if they want to kill you. What if they want to eat you like that?
Well, so thank you. Because isn't it interesting that all the famous fairy tales, the children are not at risk of simply dying. They're at risk of being eaten. And that must tell us something. That it must be far scarier to be eaten than to just simply die.
Yeah, you say in the book, more terrifying than an alien who threatens to kill you with a ray gun might be an alien who instead threatens to eat you.
And, yes.
And then you go on to talk about like your dinner. And then you're like, how do you deal with that? And that's what you do with this, though, is you ask the question away, if extraterrestrial intelligence actually exists as something that actually comes here, what does science tell us about that encounter that might actually be real and actually be true? And then you sort of break that down from the physics, from the standpoint of DNA, biology, physics, which we're going to get into. Right. And this is almost like because this is what you're so great at. You make it, all of your books are sort of practical. It's just like a guidebook or a first contact handbook on how to deal with aliens when they come.
Never leave home without it, because you never know.
Exactly.
That's going to be the day.
How could they travel across interstellar distances? What would they look like? If aliens can reach Earth, how technically advanced would they be? What would they make of our human civilization? And so just jump into some of that.
Let me just finish the nail in the coffin on the aliens who want to kill us. These aliens who visit us, if they visit us, they clearly are more technologically advanced. And right. the frequency with which they just want to lay waste to us is so high. You have to ask, what are we basing that on?
Yes.
Is it on any actual knowledge of alien conduct? No. We're supposing they would act that way based on actual knowledge of how we treat one another. Look at the history of civilization and one nation or one community encounters another, but where they have a much higher technology than the one they encounter, never ended well for the technologically less advanced culture. They'd be killed, slaughtered, enslaved, diseased, conquered, colonized. So, I think it's the aliens in our imaginations have been mirrors. Whether or not we were self-aware that we were creating a mirror to ourselves, that's what we were doing. And I'm intrigued by that. And a lot of the book looks at how we've basically crowdsourced alien
interactions.
How have we collectively imagined aliens to behave and to what they look like and how they'd get here? And I go through that and comment and analyze how much of that is realistic given the laws of physics and how much is fanciful, how much is possible, even if unlikely. And that way we can start with pop culture. I mean, why not? Because we all share that. You know, let's talk about alien representation in the Twilight Zone or in the movie Alien, right?
Right.
I mean, that's the benchmark movie for so many people, and just keep going. So I it's a celebration of human imaginations regarding aliens and a anchoring of how the science would address that.
Yeah, and I mean, you make such a good point about sort of those early 40s, 50s alien movies. There's inevitably somewhere, maybe around halfway in, the spaceship lands, and then it's a failing of soldiers with guns and bazookas and tanks. They haven't even opened the door. They just, as soon as you see its eyeballs or whatever it is, blow it up. Like, it's just so
shoot it.
Insane. And I understand, you know, that's, you know, for dramatic effect. And so it creates tension in the movie, but you're exactly right. And so,
they arrived from across the galaxy in a spaceship. And you think your gun is going to have any effect on them?
Yeah, exactly. That's the other thing. With a projectile this big. and the aliens in the ship going, "Hey, Marty, look at the thing they're shooting at us. This is hilarious." And yes,
I didn't know the alien was named Marty.
I named him Marty. There is an alien named Marty and Sherm. There's their partners and their co-captains. But you know, one of the I sort of broke this down just for myself for this conversation in sort of this many categories, but like just the idea of DNA, science, biology, right? So you say that evolution elsewhere could have a completely different starting conditions than we have. They may not even have DNA, let alone DNA that's different from us. So talk about that.
Perfectly worded.
It's truly the starting point.
It's a very important fact. So if we look at life on Earth, it's quite diverse. We brag about the diversity of life on Earth. But behind closed doors, biologists will confess to one another. Confess, I don't know if that's the right word. They will admit to one another that as diverse as life is on Earth, it all shares common DNA, everything. Mm-hmm. So take bananas, for example. Humans and bananas share 25% identical genes.
Right.
Humans and bananas. And so what you do is you look back in the tree of life and ask, when did the common ancestor between humans and bananas live? It was about 1.5 billion years ago. So some in the biology circles have called that the banana split, where we split with bananas.
Nice.
Point is, if aliens come from another planet, if they have DNA, they're going to have no DNA in common with us at all.
Right.
And if they don't have DNA, in either case, you'd expect them to look at least as different from us as we and bananas look from each other.
Right.
And so many renderings of aliens by people's imaginations over the last century do not capture this.
Right.
You know, the archetypal alien is, they have a head, two eyes, a nose, a mouth, neck, shoulders, arms, legs, feet, hands, fingers. And they're identically human. If you were a jellyfish and you saw one of these aliens standing next to a human, you could not tell the difference. Okay. If you're a jellyfish, okay, because you have other priorities about what you're supposed to look like. Or if you're an oak tree, you're looking identical to this alien. You're not distinguishing the two. So I'm so disappointed in how aliens have manifested in our imagination. So I joke, well, I only half joke. I say you have all these testimonies in Congress where high ranking officials say they've got the alien in the back shed. And so Paul, is it too much to ask for them to just bring out the alien? Am I overstepping there?
No, I think
I don't think I am. I'm just
excuse me. Neil deGrasse Tyson here, director of Hayden Fighter there. Bring out the effing alien. Come on now.
I'm tired of listening to your accounts.
Okay? Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, if DNA is like Earth's way of storing and transmitting biological information, yes, then the question becomes, what does science truly allow as an alternative basis for life, right? Like, well,
I would say is I would be most surprised if the alien that came out of the back 40 or the back shed was humanoid. That would be the most astonishing thing to me.
Right.
Completely.
Well, because, you know, like, we can expect it to be radically different than what we are. And you really make this excellent point about the Burgess Shale. And
you got that. Man, you read the book.
Of course. Yeah. And talk Thank you. I'm trying. Listen, you deserve nothing but sort of the best. And that's what I give you. Mediocre hosting. No, I mean, to put it in your pause, if you think things are weird here, look at the Burgess Shale.
Yeah.
Right?
So I would have known nothing about the Burgess Shale were it not for, because I'm not a biologist. Maybe they all know this in biology, but Stephen Jay Gould, who's an evolutionary biologist, passed maybe 20 years ago. He wrote a book called Wonderful Life, and it was an analysis of this fossil deposit called the Burgess Shale. It's in Canada. Shale is the material in which fossils were formed intact, and it's the kind of life forms that ordinary fossilization would have destroyed. So fossils, that some soft tissue was in there. Mm-hmm. And it's because shale was very kind and soft on these creatures. And they're all extinct, okay? And this was, what, half a billion years ago, just at the dawn of the Cambrian explosion of life. And this matters because we went from single-celled organisms, not very interesting, to organisms that have multiple appendages that do things, appendages that help them swim and see and sense their environments. And if you look at a catalog of these creatures, it's like, whoa.
Seven spines. One of them had seven spines.
That's what I'm saying. Nature was experimenting big time. Yeah. And not all were successful on this planet.
Nature took some psychedelics and just went to town.
Exactly.
But in this Burgess Shale, these are all these amazingly bizarre, are all collected in this one area. And you make this really excellent point is, if we can have that on Earth, aren't we being unimaginative when we just say, well, aliens are like us, but with bigger heads? Like, really? Right. Like, we have seven spines on Earth. Like, that is your point there, right?
You're right. And lately, you know, if you look at Yoda has pointy ears. Oh, right. And Spock had pointy ears. That made him alien. Cats have pointy ears. Okay. That's not even not of this Earth.
Exactly. They all have tongues and they're in the right place. Like, what? Why wouldn't the tongue be maybe over here?
Thank you.
Right above where, you know, waste comes out of the body. I don't know. But you make this excellent point about, that's really one of the key things about this book is, you're expanding our horizons. Can we think outside of this sort of box, which is a pop culture box for me, going back to movies and books and whatever. It's like, and we've been stuck in it. And you say, let's wipe away all of that and just use our heads and use science as a basis. And so here's a perfect example of that, the Burgess Shale. You
know? Yeah. And was it George Carlin or Stephen Wright, one of those two comedians who observed that, you know, how would phones be designed if our mouth and our ear were in completely different parts of our bodies?
Which is a great point.
How would you?
I said, hold on. Can you hear me? I need a third hand. Honey, get over here. I got to talk to Neil on this thing called a phone.
Yeah. And if your mouth were on your calf and your ears were on the top, you know, how would that look? So it's that kind of free thinking that it surprises you how constrained our creativity is when we're anchoring on our own bodies. It's an ego thing, perhaps. We think there's something special about our body. So clearly aliens would be designed just like us. And, you know, and ego shows up other ways, right? Like, really? The alien's going to cross the galaxy, land a spaceship, bring you into their flying saucer, and probe your anus.
Yeah, that was the other one I wanted to get to.
Is like, really? Like, really? How big is your ego?
Or your anus. Your anus. But that is like, it's the abilities that they have are beyond our comprehension, and they fixate on this place where the stuff comes out. We must go in there and like, what is the, so what is that all about? Like,
in all fairness, we have professional biologists who specialize in the poop of mammals or other creatures. Okay. Because everybody poops, or however that book. So there are people who specialize in that. That tells you about their gut, their gut biome. So I'm not saying that's not an interesting thing to study.
I know, but they don't start there. Maybe you don't start with the poop. Okay. Yeah, maybe stop wherever the brain is. I'm not going to point to my head because it may not be the, but you start with the brain, start with the central nervous system, start with whatever. You get to the, we'll do the poop, like that's four or five on the list of whatever. I'm with you. Hunters use it. They call it scat.
Yeah. And by the way, I don't know anyone who's ever found Bigfoot poop. They're always looking for Bigfoot. Look for the man's poop. Okay.
maybe he doesn't poop. Maybe that's the unique quality of Bigfoot. Maybe he's wearing nature-made Depends. And he buries them, and buries it
because you're not supposed to.
You want to be appropriate with nature, right? Exactly. So when we talk about this, like, you've already sort of hinted at a couple of these things, but like, if contact never happens, questions about aliens at least gives us insight into ourselves, right? And so it's a constructive conversation, even if they never truly appear here. So what have you come to realize about humans maybe that you hadn't realized before you wrote this book or really started to drill down on this subject?
Yeah, I think in this space, we are overvaluing politicians, because take me to your leader. Are you going to take them to the White House? Okay. I don't care who's in the White House. I refuse to believe that that's your first urge, even if that's what's requested. I refuse to believe that.
Wait, you want me to take you to my mayor who can't even pick up the garbage on time every Tuesday? No. That's not the guy you want to meet.
And maybe eventually you'll walk, give him a tour of Congress, but I think you should take it to the National Academy of Sciences, where you have biologists, astrobiologists, and physicists, and astrophysicists, and you even have cryptographers in there who can help decode. You have people whose first urge will not be to shoot.
Or probe. No shooting, no probing. You want to take them to a place where there's a sign that says no shoot, a circle with a line through it of a probing device and a gun.
Leave the scat biologist at home. We don't want
exactly.
We don't want that alien going back. They probed my butt.
The guy was the leader and he was doing the probing. I can only imagine what the underlings are doing. Oh my God.
But look at, I was reminded how powerful a force pop culture is on us. When I tried to disentangle people's thoughts and imaginings about aliens from the force of pop culture that's feeding it. Because if you draw an omni-eyed, hairless thing with a, you know, big head, arms, and I say, what is this? People just say it's an alien.
Yeah.
You'll just say that. Right. Yeah. And I say, well, how do you know? Well, because everybody knows that's an alien. Yeah. We all agree. And we agree because there's a pop culture force operating. And the hard part of the book was detaching from that tightly stitched connectivity, which frees your mind. So, for example, we have five traditional senses. And, you know, you might invite someone to a party and says, I have a sixth sense. And I generally just ignore it. No, stop. Not out of disrespect, but if I'm engaged, I let other people, and I say, you want my opinion on it? That's fine. But as a scientist, with our methods and tools of inquiry, we have dozens of senses. We can probe the universe in ways far beyond the capacity of our human physiology. I have detectors that can see infrared and ultraviolet and x-rays and gamma rays, and you can't see that with your eye. I can detect micro vibrations from earthquakes in ways you can't. I can detect ionizing radiation. You can detect it, but usually it's too late. By then, organ failure does not count as a detector. Okay.
You got to work on those organs first, buddy.
So I can measure. So what are your senses for? For receiving and decoding information outside of your body. Okay. That's right. The role of senses. So you can smell, you can see, you can taste, you can hear. What did I leave one out? You can touch.
Smell, taste, touch, see. Yeah, yeah.
So these are things outside of your body that come into you for you to then interact with your environment safely and productively. So the scientist has many more than that. So to say you have a sixth sense, I'm not impressed. And then I go on eating my pork chop, whatever, at dinner.
And they walk away going, boy, I'd like to probe that guy. He was such a jerk. I thought he was cool.
So why not open up the number of senses? And so of all people, the French philosopher, polymath, is he a polymath? He's a brilliant guy on any dimension. Voltaire in the 18th century, Voltaire wrote a story, a science fiction story about aliens. And they were called the Micromegas. That's one word, Micromegas. And it's an alien that's 26 miles tall.
Just 26. Why not?
I don't know where he got the fucking number from, but it's 26.
Exactly what I'm like. Where did he just run a marathon and it was in his head? Like, what? 26.3, I guess.
Yeah. Right. It was odd, but let's give it to him. Yeah. And this alien visits Earth. And so he's wading ankle deep in our oceans.
Of course.
This is all described. And he says, oh, that's interesting. And he goes down and picks up one of our whales. And he says, wow, that's an interesting life form. I wonder if it's, you know, sentient.
And I wonder if it tastes like mint. And then he pops it. No. And he just throws it back.
And then he found a ship, which was about the size of a whale. Yeah. But the ship had life forms on it. These were, of course, humans. And they were trying to talk to him. And he could not accept, initially, he could not accept that life forms that small could have any intelligence at all. Right? this is his bias coming back to us.
He's not that far off, by the way, when it comes to human beings. But
he's 26 miles tall, and he has more than 2,000 senses. And so he can't believe that something so tiny could have any significance in this world at all. So I devote a whole chapter to, one of them is called Alien to Us, where I describe the forms of aliens imagined and what science could say about that. But there's a whole other chapter, Alien to Them. What do we look like to the aliens? Nobody spends any time thinking about that.
Right. Nobody. That's exactly right. And what you just said is aliens would do what we do, which is we judge a book by its cover, and aliens are shallow and go, you're tiny. You can't be smart. I'm not going to talk to you. Which is, so they're pompous assholes just as much as we are, basically.
Exactly.
You've attributed the same emotional and mental state to them as you have to us. But another funny thing,
if aliens always are shown bald, that's kind of interesting. It might be weird to them to see, what's that on the top of your head?
Why do you need that?
What's
there?
It for? What? And why do people who have straight versions of this curl it, and people with curly versions have it straighten it, and people with dark hair, they lighten it? What do you do?
And what is this thing you call a mohawk? And what purpose is that? So I can just hear the guy, honey, I got abducted by aliens. You know what? Damn, I thought they were going to probe my butt. They just ran their fingers through my hair for about, I don't even know if they were fingers. They ran this thing and just kept saying, oh, you know, and asked me if it was Pantene. I didn't know, like, if it was a Pantene product I had. It's like the whole conversation.
Well, they said, oh, what cream rinse do you use?
Yeah, it's like that. What is this thing you call cream rinse? There, I'm doing the thing that like that. Why is it that voice, too? Why did we attribute that voice to that?
Exactly. I was growing up in elementary school, I went to school in Riverdale, in the Bronx, which is mostly white. And in my elementary school, there might've been four black kids. Mm-hmm. And every week, one of the kids would come up to me and want to touch my hair. So I felt like the alien trying to, it's like,
wow.
And I think they expected it to feel like steel wool, but they were surprised it was soft.
Yeah.
And they said, oh, wow, yeah. That's soft. And how do you comb it? And how do you do? So I was like the representative black person.
Oh, my God. Wow. Imagine that today.
It was early senses of how early awareness of what it would be like when an alien comes or vice versa. What you're going to look at things that are different from yourself.
Right.
And yeah.
Yeah, let's talk about physics, another category of science, sure, where the laws of physics put boundaries on plausible alien body size. You actually say the laws of physics greatly restrict the likelihood of Earth being visited by much less invaded by tiny aliens, and then go on, you know, if physics actually puts limits on what an alien would look like, then what can physics tell us about the body of something capable of being here?
Yeah, so my only point about the limit, there's a limit to how small an alien is going to be based on the laws of physics, only because
as we know them, the laws of physics,
put a pin in that and I'll get back to it and settle that with you once and for all. I will settle that. Meet me outside.
Where's the throwdown? This badass Neil deGrasse Tyson Toronto. I'm ready, baby. Let's go.
Meet me outside. So think about
it. Only if you let me touch your hair. Go ahead.
If you're tiny, like insect size, you have to ask, how would you get here through interstellar space? Are you going to make a spaceship? If you're going to make a spaceship, it means you have to fashion materials to create the ship. Mm-hmm. And if you're an ant, as strong as we like to say ants are, I did the math on this. It would take, and the number is correct in the book, is it 10,000 ants to bend a paper clip?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes.
It's and, in the that's, book. Yep. And they'd have to do it like cheerleader style, right? They have to stand up, keep your position. Okay.
Don't move. Oh, Amy, you always move. We told you not to move, Amy.
Competitive cheerleader style. just to bend a paper clip. So are they fashioning materials to and turn? So I think that's unlikely. And if you're really, really big, then the communication time between one part of your body and another, that eats up time. If you're the size of the galaxy, let's say, then the speed of light, which puts limits on this, it would take 100,000 years at the speed of light for you to scratch your head if your head itched.
because you
have an itch. That signal has to go reach your fingertips and you say, I want to scratch my head. And then you have to bring your hand over. All of that'll take like 100,000. And it's like,
wow,
is this realistic? Right.
Yes.
How many of these generations can you create? So that I think you could be too large and too small. And so that puts you sort of in a middle range. You can be much bigger than us, maybe 1/10 our size, but not much outside that realm. Now, you say laws of physics as we know them. Let me tell you this, Jack.
All right.
Can I call you Jack in that moment?
You can. Wow. I feel like I'm going to have to pull out a switchblade, but let's go, baby. I'm ready to go.
In lieu of meet me outside, I'm going to call you Jack.
Jack.
My verbal version of that.
By the way, anybody listening and watching, I think I'm about to, on an intellectual level, get my ass handed to me, but go ahead. Go ahead there, big shot.
So long ago, I wrote an essay, which I'm very proud of. It's called, you can find it online, On Earth as It Is in the Heavens. And it was not obvious to any of us that when you do an experiment on a tabletop and discover how nature behaves, that those same rules would apply on another tabletop somewhere else in the world, or on a tabletop on the moon, or anywhere else in the solar system, or anywhere else in the galaxy. It's not obvious. It's not written on a tablet that says what you find on Earth applies universally. And I mean that literally universally, not how people use the word like Miss Universe.
Okay. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
Can we finally rename that Miss Earth, please?
Yes. That's as much as we know. That's as far as we're going to go.
Yes. As far as you haven't compared her beauty to that of any other.
How about Miss Milky? Will you go with Miss Milky Way? How about that? Can we do that?
No. We need data on that.
Also, oh, wait, people saying what happens on that table. Go ahead. People also say,
No, people say this is a universal custom. They mean earthwide custom.
Yes. Right?
So
yes.
I want to reclaim that word.
Okay.
The laws of physics have been experimentally verified to be universal, not only across space, but across time.
But we have the Hubble tension where we're not even sure if the math is right, in terms of the Big Bang and everything in the black hole. So what I'm saying is, you don't know what we don't know. You don't know if these aliens that we're talking about in some other planet, some other galaxies, whatever, have a level of physics that makes our physics look like child's play, like totally eviscerates our physics. Like, you don't know that definitively.
What I can say is we have the periodic table of elements. You remember that? That was mysterious chart of boxes that hang in the front of your chemistry class.
Yes.
Were you paying attention that year?
that year? No. There were a couple of days.
Were you acting up in class and your teacher said, you know, you should be a comedian.
I'm like, no, I'm going to be a lawyer first. And then you're right. Periodic table.
That is every ingredient in the universe. And then some ingredients that we created that the universe does not have in its native cabinet. Mm-hmm. And so if there are aliens that arrive, those are the ingredients that we have here on
you
Earth.
You don't know that because we don't know that we don't have the technology sufficient to know that there aren't ingredients out there that we haven't even been able to measure yet. You can't say those are the only ingredients out there.
Yes, I can. Because a gentleman by the name of Fraunhofer, a physicist, chemist in the 19th century.
He's a discovered, hack. Go ahead. He's a
discovered
hack.
That in a spectrum, mm-hmm. you can burn an element and it'll have features in a spectrum that are unique to that element. And it comes from all the energy levels inside the element. That's what the electrons are doing. It's a fingerprint. Then he took that spectroscope and put it on a star and found exactly the same fingerprint. Mm. So that means this element discovered here is on that star. Well, let me try some other element for carbon and oxygen and nitrogen and iron. Once you do that and you look into space, not only nearby stars, but distant stars and distant galaxies, you find these fingerprints. These elements are not unique to Earth. They're a feature of the universe. Okay, so I'm telling you, in your first encounter with an alien, if you don't want it to suck out your brains, show it a periodic table of elements so that it can have some respect for your intellect.
I really should have paid attention in science class. But let's get back to that into the book in terms of we are saying because of the laws of physics as we know them here, there are limits to what the aliens could look like, how they could get here, all of that, right?
What I'm saying is, let me be more precise.
Okay.
The laws of physics that constrain the universe and the laws of physics we might not yet have discovered that give extra latitude to the aliens. And I go there, okay? Maybe the aliens live in a higher dimension. No law of physics prevents that. That would be cool.
Yeah.
Higher dimensional aliens?
Yeah.
Do you realize an alien from a higher dimension can see inside your body and reach in and meddle with the inside of your body without moving through your skin? That's fucked up.
Now you're really freaking the shit out of me. And I'm totally
is that any different? Let's see why that's true. We live in three dimensions. So let's draw two-dimensional creatures. So we're one higher dimension than they are. And they're just like stick figures in a sheet of paper.
Right. All right.
Well, if they have organs, you want to sort of expand it out so that there's an outline of their body, and inside you're going to put some organs. Okay. Right. Well, you can see right inside their body. Whereas other people in their world can only see their outer perimeter, their skin. You get to see inside because you're coming out into a third dimension and looking back down in. They can't see inside each other's bodies, but we can. So if you entered that world and you were a 3D surgeon, you could say, come on in, I'll take out your appendix, and I don't even have to cut through your skin. To go straight in. So a four-dimensional alien would be able to just go inside your body. and meddle with it. And so four-dimensional medicine, that could be a future. I'm not, when I say the laws of physics constrain it, yes, in certain ways that people have imagined, but it opens it up in so many other ways. Right. We know about wormholes, all right? If they perfect wormholes because they find a negative gravity substance, which mm-hmm. we've never found before, I'm giving them that. Give them a negative gravity substance, which has negative gravity. That's what you need to pry open a wormhole and keep it open. Negative gravity. Because what does gravity do? It brings things together, ultimately in a black hole. Negative gravity would pry it apart. So you get negative gravity, position it in space, bada bing, you got a wormhole. So then the aliens come via a wormhole. But if that's the case, then they don't need spaceships. What do you need a spaceship? Just step through.
Step through and you're there.
Like Morty, like Rick and Rick and Morty, you just step through the hole.
Right.
And so wormholes would be an achievement of aliens that we don't have that they could fully exploit. But that means they wouldn't be crashed flying saucers. And what's up with that? Why are aliens coming across the galaxy and they crash on? That's what kind of navigating aliens?
Right, exactly. all that level of sophistication is like, oh, this is the only part I suck at.
Well, I don't want to meet that alien. Give me the one who knows how to navigate. Okay, thank you.
But the other thing you talk about in the book is you say mathematics is the language of the universe, right? Yes. What mathematics represents to us may not. How do we establish that the first common scientific vocabulary with an alien, a species, through mathematics, when our mathematics may not be their mathematics or be different from theirs in some way?
Well, obviously, our symbols would be different, but you'd have to find some way to share a common mathematical concept without relying on having to use the same symbols. Right. So one of them would be the Pythagorean triangle. Okay. I hope you weren't asleep in class when you did that one. Or did the teacher say you should become a comedian again?
It's weird. They said that in all of my classes, English, history, science.
Okay. I'll catch you up on it then. Yeah, so if you have a triangle and one angle is a right angle, which is 90 degrees, and there's a very clean formula that connects the length of the two sides of the triangle that flank the right angle to the third side, which we call the hypotenuse. Okay. You might remember these words. Point is, I can write down that formula, but they're not going to know our symbols or anything. But what I can do is, by the way, do you remember the formula?
I do not.
A squared plus B squared equals C squared.
The C squared. Not, as you said, the first part, I was getting the second of there.
You get the second part, right. So A is the length of one leg. C is the length of second leg. A B is the second. C is the third. A squared. Mm-hmm. But so you go A times A plus B times B equals C times C. Okay.
Right.
Got that? All right. Now, here's the genius part. If I have a square and one side of it is of length A, what's the area of that square?
A squared. A squared.
Right? It's A squared. Yeah. It's A times A. Yeah, A squared. Right. Mm-hmm. Oh, wait a minute. So if I take one of those legs of length A and just draw a square off of the triangle and then draw a square off the other leg and then draw a square off the hypotenuse. And I show that to an alien. That is a geometric representation of Pythagorean theorem. Which A squared, B squared equals C squared. We have three squares, actual squares. The physical square, not just the number two when they told you to go A times A. I have a square.
Which they will understand. They will acknowledge and understand because it's an absolute in the
completely.
Universe.
Completely. And I'm not the first to come up with that. Some brilliant minds of the 19th century and earlier, Gauss is among them. He had an idea where you would put, is it logs or put it in a wheat field and delineate sides in a wheat field, huge, like miles on a side. And then you'd fell the wheat on three of the sides so that it takes a different color, a different shade, because wheat can take different colors depending on if it's trammeled or straight up. And I think one of them said at night you could light it up, and then any aliens on the moon, back then people would happy to think that there were life forms on the moon, would see this lit up Pythagorean triangle. My only point here is there's basic math
and that basic doesn't require physics, our same thing. Yeah.
That if they knew anything about how the universe works, they would know this. They would know that there's such a thing as pi. Pi shows up everywhere in our math and physics. Mm-hmm. So they would have something about pi. So I would show a circle and a diameter, and I pull off the diameter and show how many times around the circle it goes. That's pi, without me even saying pi. So I would bring my periodic table of elements. I'd bring some basic geometric tools, just again to alert the alien that we're smart there's enough.
There's some fundamental. Yeah,
correct.
One of the other things, and as you like to say, when you're hosting your show, we're going to land this puppy in a minute, but
land the plane. I don't fly puppies.
See, this is why you ruin everything when you talk. This whole idea, are we intelligent enough for them to bother communicating with us? Like, what about us is baffling? You know, like
I lay awake at night.
Yeah.
Paul, I lay awake at night wondering that. Because we, if we're the first intelligent species the world has ever seen, and by the way, who declared us to be intelligent?
We did.
We did. Okay, fine.
But they got to be looking at us going, hang on a second, guys, let me get this straight. So this species, these earthlings, they can map the human genome, and but they cannot. They cannot avoid killing each other when they try to merge into one lane. What is that all about? Or they have this thing called the cell phone, the most sophisticated tool that they have. And what do they use it for? To watch cat videos and argue over whether the earth is round. Yes. I feel like there's a certain barrier to entry for these aliens to us, and it's us.
And in the community of intelligent aliens. Right, yes. Right. So I lay awake, but I have a deeper thought than even that. Not only would aliens consider us to be intelligent at all, but do we have sufficient intelligence to even figure out the universe? Are there questions of the universe that will lay forever out of reach because we do not have the depth of neurological capacity to address it? I'd lay awake at night wondering that. Now, the only thing that gets me out of it is you, Paul, don't have to invent calculus to solve a problem that requires calculus. Isaac Newton did that for you.
Right.
All right. So you could advance the world without having to be the one who invented the tools to do it. And so maybe, you know, once a century, a really brilliant person comes along with new tools. And we just slowly go one rung on the ladder at a time, where no one person could have ascended the ladder themselves. So maybe collectively as a species, we can garner enough intellect to earn a seat at the alien table. But think about the simplest sentence you could utter that would be unintelligible to a chimp. Right? You say, what's a good chimp name? Bonzo. I'm going into town and there's a new shipment of bananas at the grocery store. I can pick some up for you. But I'm going to stop at Starbucks, get some coffee, and I'll come back with like two bunches of bananas. And like, what does the chimp hear?
Right.
Blah, 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 blah. Bananas. Blah, 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 blah. Bananas. Okay. So imagine this intelligent species of alien uttering their simplest thoughts. And all we can grasp is an occasional syllable that sounds, you know, what do we care about? Like food, sex, and shelter, right? That's all we're going to pay attention to.
Exactly. I have a woman with a pizza. I got it. I understand. They said they have a woman with a pizza. This is the best thing ever. Yeah.
And we're completely distracted by that. Those little bits. How easy it would be to just imprison us. Another thing I comment on is, octopuses are, you know, after that movie came out, my octopus teacher, people stopped ordering octopus in restaurants. I thought that was pretty wild.
Yeah.
You know, how about the bacon you still order?
God, I had, don't get me started. I had a piece last night and it was delicious. Don't get me started.
I'm just saying, pigs are smart too. And they may even be smarter than the octopus, but don't, you know, don't cherry pick your animals. Just be honest with yourself if you're doing that. All right. So what I imagine, if octopuses ruled the world and they wanted to put Paul Mercurio in prison, they would just need to put you in a room with a door that had three doorknobs. And you're never getting out.
Come on. I don't like you at all. Wait, I can get out.
How are you going to get out?
Are they randomly locked? Is that what you're saying?
No, unlocked door. They're not even locked. How are you going to open three doorknobs?
Like open one. I open the third with my other hand. Then I wrap my arm. Shut up. I wrap my arm. So let's say I have to go clockwise to open it. I open one with one hand. So they're both clockwise. Both hands are occupied. I slide my forearm holding those in position to do the third. Why would that be hard?
Okay. So then the octopus will say, okay, we got a clever one here. Let's move the doorknobs a little farther apart.
Oh, that's annoying. There you go.
That prison doesn't even require a key. That's what I'm saying. So an octopus.
Your point in that is what? In all seriousness,
they can trivially open doors, doorknobs, octopuses, because they have the tentacles that can do that and they can figure it out. So we are not some pinnacle of design that all other animals are somehow subservient to us.
Right.
Other animals have interesting features. And I talk about this, you know, why not give aliens the power of regeneration, to regenerate limbs.
Right.
Newts can do this.
Okay? Yes. This is so true. Well, you say in the book, there's a quote of yours, being smart and technically proficient are not the same thing.
Correct.
Explain why that distinction is important in the context of this conversation about aliens and in general, I guess.
So you could be smart, but if you have no technology to communicate across the gaps of space, then no one is talking to you in the galaxy.
Right.
So let's say aliens sent signals to Earth that reached Earth 2000 years ago. Well, it lands on the Roman Empire. Right. Do they have radio telescopes?
Exactly. It's like, and the aliens are like, man, these Earthlings are rude. 2000 years ago, we left them a message and they didn't even return the call.
So no one would deny intelligence to the Roman Empire, but it's the technology that enables most of what we care about.
We're
talking about the visiting aliens.
Which gets back to the limitations of our level of intelligence, the tech. It's all sort of intertwined.
Again, I want to emphasize that there's plenty of things aliens could have that are still within the known laws that are far beyond anything we have yet to achieve. So I'm not using what we have achieved as the limits. I'm using the laws of physics that enable what we achieve as a guide.
Willing to admit, not without being, and you're not being a pompous earthling, to think they have a level of science, a level of physics and understanding that's more sophisticated than ours. That's all possible. You admit that that's possible.
Oh, completely. Completely.
Yeah.
And by the way, we see these laws of physics manifest across the universe. We see binary stars. You know, when Newton's laws came out, gravity interacting between two objects, and they worked for Earth and the moon, they worked for Earth and the sun. And then we discovered Jupiter's moons. It worked for them too. And he didn't even come up with this law for Jupiter's moons. But there's Jupiter and its moon, so it doesn't require a star. It just requires objects that have gravity. And are these laws just in our own solar system? Mm. Then we found two stars that were suspiciously close to one another on the sky. Were they a chance alignment or did they know about each other? Turns out they knew about each other and they were called binary stars. And we timed their orbits and we said they're doing exactly what we expect for Newton's laws, which means Newton's laws apply outside of our solar system. And we did this incrementally, which is why we can stand flat-footed and say these laws of physics apply throughout space and across time, because the farther out you look in space, the farther back in time you're looking.
Yes.
So we get space and time combined.
Fine.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I want to wrap up with a simple question.
You're going to land the puppy. Yeah, okay.
Alien appears to you in 5 minutes from now. What is the first thing you ask and or want to know of them, assuming you can communicate with them with your tiny, tiny brain?
The first thing I... You speak of me like I have the tiny brain.
Okay. Well,
it's not our tiny brain as humans, but my tiny brain as Neil deGrasse
Tyson. I'm assuming this alien is 26 miles tall, so you have a tiny brain.
Yeah, I would first try to find a common vocabulary.
Let's assume you have that. So
then
you can
try to
communicate.
Find out what do they know about the universe that we don't? And I might try to come up with something that we know about the universe that they don't. And that's my curiosity manifesting.
Yeah.
And like, for example, in the periodic table of elements, in the section where we're inventing every one of the elements, they're very unstable. Like they decay in fractions of a second. It is calculated that there's a region of elements, which we're calling the island of stability, where if you can get into these huge elements, that they won't decay. And I would ask the alien, have they gotten to this island of stability? Are those elements actually stable? And if they are stable, have they found any interesting uses for them?
Yes.
Okay, Paul, you're old enough to remember when we grew up. Do you remember they used to coat furniture and curtains with flame retardant? Do you remember that? The children had flame retardant pajamas.
Yes.
Have you heard about flame retardant anymore? Where's the last time you heard about that?
No,
you haven't. Holding aside whether it might have given us all cancer, what turned out to be way more useful and effective than flame retardant underwear were smoke detectors.
Okay. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Good point. Yeah. Okay. Hey guys, I got an idea. Let's
alert you five rooms away that you should get out of the friggin' home. Right. Not wait until your pajamas are igniting on fire for you to leave.
Or have to walk around in very uncomfortable underwear that will ultimately cause cancer. So yes.
Right.
Yes.
So do you know what enabled modern smoke detectors is the element californium, an element discovered in labs in California. It's a modern element. It came out in like the 70s or 80s, and it had a use in smoke detectors.
And is that the element we talked about this in one of the shows we did recently for Star Talk, that there was a missing element?
That's a different
table.
That was a different element called technetium. That was a gap in the table. We naturally found elements all around it. We had to manufacture that one. So that was anomalous. The very heavy ones, we manufacture all of them. My only point is, what properties might exist in this island of stability that we could exploit in our modern civilization that we don't yet know? Do they know this? Please tell me.
Yes.
And also, I think I would end with... you have great advances in your culture. Can you tell us how to survive ourselves?
That is exactly.
And I would say, stay away. Don't look too close to the earth, because you'll see people slaughtering one another because of skin color, how they pray, who they sleep with, what they eat.
We created these lines in the earth.
Exactly.
And also,
don't look at any of that. They might say, we already did. We are leaving immediately.
Yes.
There's no sign of intelligent life on Earth.
Please ignore the fact that whenever the plane lands, there's always some asshole that has to stand up too soon and get to the front of the plane. Please ignore that. And by the way, the Island of Stability is a really great reality show on TLC, everybody. You're going to really love it.
That's a great phrase.
Take me to your leader. Great. great book. This is one of many that Neil
look
has.
Look at all your stickums in there.
Yeah, I got some post-its. They don't come, the post-its are, you got to add them yourself, but this is my crazy methodology. But it's a great book and obviously a great conversation, and love having you on.
Well, thanks, Paul. And I hope you're not just saying that because we intermittently employ you on my podcast.
No, I'm going to be editing that part out later. So no. And it's such so great, and always appreciate getting the guest co-host.
And just so you know, I'm a big fan of humor in general and stand-up comedy. And I know it's a huge part of what you do. And yeah. I hope you may have noticed that the book is rich with places where it might make you smile.
And
just because I value what I've learned from professional comedians. When people smile while they're learning, they come back for more.
And the book is rife with that. And that's always been your sort of one of your amazing strengths, is sort of the ability to make it relatable and not a snooze fest and understandable, but also entertaining at the same time and have a sense of humor about it all. And also, the idea, what I really loved about the book is sort of how it's a mirror on this conversation can be a mirror onto us. And I think that's a really smart, important point to make. So this book has everything. It has facts. It has entertainment. It's got some compromising photos of Neil with an alien. We won't talk about that, but he's
no, I basic- fuzzed those out. I put a fuzz over.
No, he's basically cuddling with a 26-mile alien. You're gonna love it. It's in the book.
I was on the Today Show a couple of mornings ago, and they asked me, "What's the one takeaway from the book that I would offer people?" And I said, on that first encounter, and I said, if the alien walks up to you and has some appendage sticking out in front of it, don't grab it and shake it and say, "Welcome to Earth." You don't know what part of the anatomy that the alien that is.
You don't know where that thing has been.
And you don't want to find out. Exactly. And I realized this was the morning show, and I probably shouldn't have joked that way.
That's hilarious. No, that's what they need. Everybody in America was spitting their coffee out of the same time when you said that.
But it's true. That's not a deep dive.
I can see a mother like rushing out the door with that on. You hear that, Johnny? If an alien comes and gets you and he has a thing, don't touch it until you ask him where it's been. And don't be like Neil. Don't get on just any spaceship that shows up because you're interested. You got to be careful. You're the best, Neil deGrasse Tyson. All right, brother. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks. Yep,
love you.
There you go. That is the man, Neil Tyson. Nobody better. Neil deGrasse Tyson, I should say. And hope to check me out on the road. Go to my website, palmycurio.com. I'm going to be in Richmond, Virginia, the Tin Pan in September 26th. October 22nd, 23rd, Minneapolis, Minnesota at the House of Comedy. November 7th, the Guard Theater, doing my Broadway show, Permission to Speak. November 13th and 14th, stand up at Ram's Head in Annapolis, Maryland. Thanks for checking out the show, everybody, and I hope to see you on the road.